frailty is the number one cause of your dying. And you will avoid frailty by eating meat and organs along with good sources of carbohydrates. Life changer. Check out this amazing review on Mood, Memory, and Brain from Heart and Soil. I've been taking Mood, Memory, and Brain for approximately 2 months. I just started my new career as a registered nurse working night shift. It has been a very difficult adjustment. Since April of 2018, I've felt disconnected from life, depressed, and anxious, like something was wrong with me mentally, and I had perpetual brain fog. I considered trying therapy and maybe even antidepressants. When I started my new job, I had horrendous anxiety before coming into work, and my mood was very low. The person I am now is a whole new being. Taking Mood, Memory, and Brain has and continues to improve my overall well-being. My brain fog is fading, and I'm finding my old self again, the self who was bubbly, witty, and happy. I can't even begin to thank Heart and Soil for what they've done for me. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Mood, Memory, and Brain contains desiccated brain, liver, and bone marrow. And this is one of our most popular supplements at Heart and Soil. As I've spoken about on the podcast many times, there are incredible benefits to taking desiccated brain. If you heard last week's podcast with Georgie Zinkov, there are unique hormones in the brain, including pregnenolone, and there are cofactors that have been studied to improve cognitive decline as we age. You can find Mood, Memory, and Brain and all of our supplements at heartandsoil.co. They're all grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised, and always packaged in glass because plastic is bullshit. On this week's podcast, the debunking had to come out. Someone sent me an article, and it's a long article, so I hit the highlights in this podcast about why meat accelerates aging and why meat is bad for you from all the angles. So I thought it was kind of a comprehensive article that I would attempt to debunk as best as possible to provide more evidence for that for you all. I've done multiple podcasts with vegans in the past, and this is more evidence in this podcast, more things for you to chew on about why meat is not harmful for humans, but that meat and organs desiccated like hardened soil or fresh are essential for every human who hopes to be optimal. So enjoy this podcast. It's essentially a takedown of most of the vegan plant-based arguments about why meat is bad for your health. I want to give a shout out to my sponsors of this episode of the podcast. They make this possible. First, I want to give a shout out to BonCharge, BonCharge.com. You can get 15% off using the code CarnivoreMD. The laptop that I'm using to record this podcast, this intro, is on an EMF blocking mat from BonCharge. The earbuds that I use in my computer and adapt for my iPhone are from BonCharge. They are EMF reducing. I am worried about EMFs. I might even be somebody that you could accuse of wearing a tinfoil hat. I turn my Wi-Fi off at night, but I've seen so many people use their laptops on their laps. Do not do that. Get one of these EMF blocking mats for you, your loved ones. Do not put your laptop on your lap. We do not fully understand what happens with this non-ionizing radiation. And get rid of your AirPods. Get some of these earbuds from BonCharge. You will appreciate them, and I think it'll be good for you long-term. Again, you can find them at BonCharge, BonCharge.com. You can use the code CarnivoreMD to save 15% off BonCharge.com. I also want to give a shout out to the sponsor, Let's Get Checked. They're a sponsor of this podcast. You can find them at trylgc.com/Paul Saladino, and you'll get 25% off your blood work order there. So let's talk about today's sponsor, Let's Get Checked. Are you the man that your father was? I've been talking a lot about testosterone recently. Recent studies have shown that men's testosterone levels are dropping substantially since the 1980s, about 1% per year. If you're 30 years old, you could have 30% less testosterone than your dad did when he was this age. Not a good thing. We don't know why this is happening. Probably polyunsaturated fatty acids, microplastics, perfluoroalkylated substances, PFAs. I think if you eat clean, good food, you'll avoid this, but you got to know what your testosterone is and you got to check this, which is why Let's Get Checked can help with this. I really appreciate what they're doing. They are doing at-home blood work testing for male hormones that make it easy. So I've done testing from Let's Get Checked at my home. It was super easy. They sent me the tests in a discreet envelope. I had CRP, male hormones, CBC, Chem7, lipids tested. It was really easy. You can collect the blood yourself at home and the results will be available to you online within 2 to 5 days. The results are reviewed by a clinician. A member of Let's Get Checked nursing team may call you to review your results. They're CLIA approved and CAP accredited, which are the highest ranking levels of accreditation. So if you want to test your hormone levels, without having to leave your home, visit trylgc.com/PaulSaladino. That is PAULSALADINO, and get 25% off your test using the code PaulSaladino. All right, guys, thank you to Let's Get Checked. Also want to give a shout out to 8Sleep, 8Sleep.com, EIGHTSLEEP.com. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD to save $150 on the 8Sleep Pod Pro cover. They currently ship within the US, Canada, and the UK, select countries in the EU and Australia. So here's the deal, guys. I hate being hot in the middle of the night. And most mattresses just make me sweat like crazy because they're not built to get rid of body heat. That's why I love the 8Sleep Pod Pro cover. It fits on any mattress and allows you to adjust the temperature of your sleeping environment, providing the optimal temperature that gets you the best night's sleep. They have dual zone temperature control. You and your partner can set different sides of the bed as cool as 55 or as hot as 110. It monitors your biometrics like HRV, so you wake up in the morning and you've got all sorts of data to look at. Better sleep is the health habit that you will love sticking to night after night. Wake up fully energized with a Pod Pro cover so you can tackle whatever life throws at you. Go to 8Sleep, EIGHTSLEEP, 8Sleep.com/CarnivoreMD and save $150 on the 8Sleep Pod Pro cover. Upgrading your sleep is an incredible investment. Did you know? Every year, humans dump 8 million tons of plastic garbage in the ocean, which is where the next sponsor, Kalima Sea Salt, comes in. You can go to drpaulsalt.com to get a free bag of Kalima Sea Salt. 8 million tons of plastic garbage, that's where your table salt comes from. Garbage breaks down into tiny pieces of plastic called microplastics. No bueno. Salt crystallizes around that. A new study reveals that microplastics are found in 90% of all salt tested, but not Kalima. It is free from ocean-borne microplastics. You'll get your first bag free at drpaulsalt.com, and it is a freaking delicious, super crunchy, and great finishing salt. Get this, it's harvested from the Kalima salt flats in Mexico. So you're supporting local industries and the salineros in the Kalima salt flats in Mexico. It's 100% all natural, unrefined, handmade, hand-harvested sea salt. Check it out, drpaulsalt.com, for your free bag of Kalima sea salt. On to the podcast. I get asked frequently to do more debates with plant-based advocates. And in the show notes, I will put a link for previous debates I've done with plant-based advocates, vegans, etc. I've done multiple episodes with this on the podcast, including plant-based advocates like Joel Fuhrman and many others. But these are difficult to do for a variety of reasons. It's difficult to get vegans and plant-based advocates to actually come on the podcast. It's difficult to get them to agree to a debate in the first place. And it's difficult to find platforms when they won't come on my show that they're happy with. So in lieu of more of those plant-based debates, though I hope more will happen in the future, this week I will tackle head-on a pretty crazy article that was sent to me by someone in email talking about why animal protein-rich diets accelerate aging. And wrapped into this article is a lot of conjecture. There's a lot of epidemiology and observational evidence, and a lot of, I would say, false paradigms, false thinking around all of this that creates a total house of cards. I've done a podcast on longevity in the past. Please refer to that one if you would like lots of detail here. Having said that, this podcast will be very detailed. There will be a lot of articles in this podcast, and it will be complex. So I'll do my best throughout it to stay high level, but there's no really high level way to do this. But I thought this article was a good summary of almost all of the plant-based arguments I've seen, almost all of the anti-meat arguments I've seen. And a lot of it is starting to take this longevity angle. So let's attack it head on and really try to get to the bottom of this. As always, don't take what I'm saying as gospel or canon. Do your own research, think for yourself, and ultimately do your own experiments. See how you feel best, because I think that that will be the ultimate arbiter for you. I was speaking with Bear Grylls, who's a friend of mine, via text this morning. He sent me another podcast on why carnivore diets are horrible. And I said to him, hey man, I've seen all these arguments before. They're very complex for people to really understand the science. And he said, yeah, I agree. I think that basically look at nature was his perspective, and I agree with him. And I think you'll see what's going on. So that's why I've tried to incorporate anthropology in the past, why I went to visit the Hadza in Tanzania. And at a high level, though it's not a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, looking at hunter-gatherers, We always ate meat as humans, undeniably. We continue to eat meat as humans, as hunter-gatherers, and there is no tribe on earth that doesn't eat meat that has been successful as vegetarians. Looking at Weston Price's work, you can see that tribes who ate more plant foods were generally shorter, less muscular, and less robust than tribes that ate more animal foods. So again, this is just historical evidence, but I think it creates a frame for this entire discussion and gives us some semblance of a reality check so we don't get too lost in the data. But I'll try to bring us back to reality throughout this podcast as well. So this is the article that I'm going to be going through in this podcast. It looks like it was just published in January of 2023, so very recently. The title is Why High Animal Protein, in parentheses, Carnivore Diets Accelerate Aging. Obviously, I don't believe high animal protein diets accelerate aging or are harmful for humans really in any way, shape, or form, but let's just set a couple of ground rules at the start. What is high animal protein? Well, I would recommend that you get 1 gram of animal protein per pound of body weight. Most people would say that's a high animal protein diet. I don't think plant protein is really worth much of anything. It has a much lower DIAS, much lower digestible, indispensable amino acid score, and it comes with all of the other negative baggage of plant proteins, anti-nutrients, lectins, oxalates, phytic acid, digestive enzyme inhibitors. These compounds, many of them will inhibit mineral absorption and create nutrient deficiency, even beyond the minerals that many of these plants contain. So I'm not a huge fan of plant proteins, lectins, damaging the gut, etc. If you want protein, why not just get it from animal foods and organs like your ancestors always have? But there is a group of people who believe this is bad for you. And as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, this seems to have found some camaraderie in the longevity movement. So I will do my best to debunk this and show the case that I believe is on the other side of this issue. So right from the outset, I think it's also important to clarify that I do not eat a strictly carnivorous diet. I think the word carnivore diet is interesting. I think that the terminology carnivore means that you're getting the majority of your nutrients from animal foods. And I certainly do that. I've done that for the majority of my life, probably, except when I was a vegan, and I've told that story in the past. But even when I was on a paleo diet, I got the majority of my nutrition from animal foods. Right now, most of you know I eat what I've termed an animal-based diet to distinguish it from a strictly carnivorous diet. A strictly carnivorous diet is something that is meat and organs and animal fat and salt. I did that for about 1.5 years and ended up with issues related to long-term ketosis that I've discussed in previous podcasts. Adding back low-toxicity carbohydrates in the form of fruit, honey, raw dairy, and maple syrup and helped with that enormously. And I feel like there's a good happy medium here. An animal-based diet is meat and organs as the centerpiece. An animal-based diet is animal foods as the centerpiece, meat, organs, eggs, dairy, cheese as the centerpiece, and then carbohydrates from the least toxic sources of carbohydrates, namely fruit. The colorful parts of plants, which are fruit, fruit juices, honey has a lot of good evidence for it that I've shared in the past. Even maple syrup appears to be totally benign or even beneficial for humans because it's a good source of manganese. So this is an animal-based diet. I think it allows a lot more people to come into this world of a diet that is free from what I believe are the most toxic plant foods, the vegetables, the leaves, the stems, the roots, the seeds of plants, and still get lots of nourishment and still get carbohydrates and avoid the complications of long-term ketosis. Those are things I've discussed in previous podcasts. I'm not going to go into them in great detail here. Please refer to those in the past if you want to understand any of those individual pieces. So looking at this article, they say, we understand why many carnivore diet fans have strong opinions about plant-based diets and why plant-based dieters sometimes vehemently oppose meat-based diets. But both have some good points and some bad points. So at least in this article, they're admitting that plant-based diets are not the be-all and end-all, but they definitely take a plant-based perspective in this article, as you will see. So they say, it's remarkable, but also understandable that quite a lot of people still think high animal protein or high meat diets are healthy in light of so much evidence to the contrary. Well, I think a lot of people believe that high animal protein or high meat diets are healthy because they're thriving on these diets with better libido, better muscle mass, look better naked, more energy, more mental clarity, and stronger bones, etc. So why should you believe the people in this article? Good question. I don't believe them. They say their view is that high animal protein diets are unhealthy in the long term because a high meat intake accelerates fundamental aging processes, whether your meat is grass-fed and antibiotic-free or not. Now, this is one thing that I will take issue with throughout this podcast. There is really no good evidence, and this is where we get back to this house of cards. They will, in this article, as I will show you repeatedly, consistently point to epidemiology, observational studies to remind us that in the Western world, plant-based dieters sometimes appear to be better from a cardiovascular disease perspective or a morbidity and mortality perspective. Now, again, these are observational studies. There is no actual research here with an intervention. These are surveys that are done, and we know these are confounded consistently by things called healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias. If you're not familiar with those terms, healthy user bias means that people who generally eat plant-based do other healthy behaviors, because what has been the narrative in the West for the last 70 years? That meat is bad for you. That's thanks to Ansel Keys in the 1950s and 1960s. And unhealthy user bias is the exact opposite. We're looking at people who still eat meat in spite of the dietary advice, which is prevailing, and they also tend to drink more, smoke more, not go to colonoscopies, mammograms. They don't play tennis on Sunday with their friends. They're also a lower socioeconomic status. They may or may not ride motorcycles. They may do dangerous things. You get the idea. Unhealthy user bias, healthy user bias. And we know this to be the case, confounding so many of these studies looking at meat. And I'll show evidence for that later in this podcast. And I'll show evidence that if you look in Asia, where the narrative is completely different, specifically that meat is associated with affluence, men who eat the most red meat have the lowest rates of heart disease, and women who eat the most red meat have the lowest rates of cancer, including breast cancer. So is it that meat is good for Asians but bad for the West? No, it's that observational studies are basically junk. They give us some indication of where we might direct randomized controlled studies, and sometimes randomized controlled studies, interventional studies, are not actually possible. So then we have to do the best we can, but we must understand their flaws, and we must understand that piling a bunch of observational studies on top of each other, calling it a meta-analysis and saying that's the weight of the evidence or the best amount of evidence, is akin to calling a landfill a high-value piece of real estate because there's a bunch of garbage there. If you just keep piling garbage into a landfill, you're not going to end up with a multi-million dollar condo on the 25th floor penthouse. You're going to end up with a mountain of garbage. And that's essentially what most meta-analyses of epidemiology are, because every individual piece of that meta-analysis, every individual study, is epidemiology. Now, to be fair, I have used epidemiology studies in my book, The Carnivore Code, in my reels on Instagram, in my YouTube videos. I always include the caveat that these are observational studies, and I challenge people to suggest ways they might be confounded. Specifically, let's take an example. I sent my friend Joe Rogan some studies about seed oils and macular degeneration. And if you look at the observational studies with seed oils and macular degeneration, you will find that seed oils are consistently associated with higher levels of macular degeneration in humans. Now, this is observational. We can't draw a causative inference, but there is no healthy user bias or unhealthy user bias at play here, because people who eat seed oils are generally people who are adhering to the mainstream dietary advice. So they should be healthier. They're doing healthy behaviors. When we see a divergence there, we start to question this, and it looks to be a very compelling finding with regard to these observational studies and seed oils. And then we go on the back end, we look at the mechanistic studies. I've done tons of podcasts on seed oils talking about why these are harmful for humans. And so you can look at the mechanistic reasons. There'll be more of that coming with Georgi Dinkov in the future, but I have many podcasts on why seed oils are harmful, and many podcasts, including the podcast from, I believe, 1 or 2 weeks ago, talking about seed oils with regard to cardiovascular disease. And well, the macula is the back of the eye. It's a very vascular part of the body. So is it reasonable to think that if seed oils are leading to atherosclerosis or leading to oxidized LDL and increased Lp(a), very strong risk factors for atherosclerotic progression, that this could lead to macular degeneration? Yes, it all makes sense. That's how we think about epidemiology. Does it make sense in the broader context? Is it in danger of being confounded by healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias? And what can we do to test this hypothesis if possible? So take all of that into account as you're thinking about observational studies. So back to the article, they say why meat eaters often believe their diet is, quote, healthy. Often fans of high animal protein diets like paleo diet, caveman diet, carnivore diet, Atkins diet, or Dukan diet feel very strongly about their way of eating. They think their diet is the best one. Well, it's probably because they feel good. Some reasons why. People on high animal protein diet can feel great. Yeah, no shit. They might feel stronger, have more energy, build more muscle, lose weight, improve insulin resistance, and so on. Okay, yeah, I agree with this. They might also have more libido, better erections, look better naked, and, you know, get closer to living the life of their dreams. Now, this is where the authors of this article go off the rail. They say, however, these are short-term effects. Okay, yes, they are short-term effects, but their next statement is where they really go off the rails, Looking at the long-term effects of high animal protein diets stretching over decades, it would be clear that this kind of diet accelerates aging and can increase the risk of aging-related diseases, including heart disease and cancer. And they give no references for this. So this is where they've essentially admitted that people who eat significant amounts of animal meat and organs feel good, look good, perform well. That's really indisputable. You can look at strict vegans who don't take tons of synthetic protein powder, who don't use anabolic steroids, and they're basically sarcopenic, meaning they're skinny fat. They have not a lot of muscles on their body. They often have kind of guts from bloating and gas or whatever. Don't go on any long car rides with vegans. That's my tidbit of advice to you all. And so it's very difficult to make an argument that animal protein is harmful in the short term. So the only argument left for plant-based or vegan proponents to make is that they must be harmful in the long term. The only problem is that there's never going to be a randomized, controlled, long-term study. So what are we left with? Oh, we're left with epidemiology, observational studies, and we know the flaws of those. And the studies that contradict the advanced narrative that plant-based diets are healthier are left out, like the study on Asians and their benefits from meat. Let me show you that study right now. I've shown this one in the past many times, but the title is Meat Intake and Cause-Specific Mortality, a Pooled Analysis of Asian Prospective Cohort Studies. This study looked at close to 300,000 participants, and I will read their conclusion. Ecological data indicate an increase in meat intake in Asian countries. However, our pooled analysis did not provide evidence of a higher risk of mortality for total meat intake and provided evidence of an inverse association with red meat, poultry, and fish and seafood. The people in Asia who ate more meat died less. Red meat intake was inversely correlated with cardiovascular mortality in men and cancer mortality in women in Asian countries. So in order to make any argument that looks at long-term data, we must ignore large studies in parts of the world where the prevailing narrative regarding red meat is different than it is in the West. But this is conveniently done by so many plant-based advocates. So this is the argument advanced by plant-based advocates, guys. You'll feel great, you'll look great, and you'll perform well eating animal meat and organs, but that's gotta be short-term, except ignore all of these Asian studies with people with a different prevailing narrative. Okay, they go on to say, sometimes people on a high animal protein diet do not only feel better, but they can also improve specific diseases such as multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis. Well, yes, let's add to the list eczema, asthma, psoriasis, Sjogren's, irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, retinopathy, macular degeneration, diabetes, obesity, erectile dysfunction, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. The list is very long. Autoimmune thyroid disease, Graves' disease. It's an insane list. We know that your diet is often at the root of these autoimmune issues. But the authors of this article have to give another caveat. However, this is not so much because of the meat, as meat can be pro-inflammatory. Well, that's a false statement. There is no good evidence for that. And I've talked about that in the past. But mainly because this diet can reduce inflammation via various other mechanisms. For example, when following high animal protein diets, people often substantially reduce their intake of pro-inflammatory sugars and refined carbs. Well, yeah, I would agree with that. By consuming less sugary and starchy foods like bread, pasta, potatoes, and rice, which authors here also recommend. So I'm on the same page with them here. I don't worry about sugar in the form of fruit, honey, maple syrup, or milk, but I think that starchy foods like bread, potatoes, pasta, rice are a problem for humans for a variety of reasons, not least of which is gut inflammation leading to endotoxin and all of the downstream effects of that, as I've talked about in the past with Georgi Dinkov. Meat-based eaters, they say in this article, may also eat less junk food, more vegetables, well, not on a carnivore diet, and consume more healthy anti-inflammatory fats. Well, possibly, except if they're doing most of these diets, they're not consuming polyunsaturated fats, they're consuming saturated fats, which are the true anti-inflammatory fats. They continue while consuming fewer substances that can cause autoimmune diseases like gluten, soy, or dairy. I think raw dairy is not going to cause any autoimmune issues, and I will do a little segment to this podcast about the benefits of dairy in a moment. So in a certain way, a carnivore diet is also a restriction diet. Well, I would agree with that, and so is an animal-based diet. However, given meat and various fats in meat can also induce inflammation, reducing meat intake combined with low glycemic vegetables, legumes, mushrooms, and healthy fats would be even more beneficial. That is where I disagree with them. Meat and various fats in meat do not induce inflammation. And the references they provide to substantiate that claim are pretty bogus. This is the first article they use to support the claim that meat is inflammatory, which is a follow-up on the IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer Evaluation, in 2015. And in this article, they are going to use a lot of hypotheses to say that things like N-nitrosyl compounds, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and heterocyclic amines are harmful for humans. Well, if that's the case, then why did our ancestors thrive? And if you believe that our ancestors died early, you have some research to do. And you need to understand that infant mortality confounds estimates of life expectancy. So why do the Hadza not have any real evidence of chronic disease, obesity, diabetes, or autoimmunity, or cancer when all of these things are so harmful in meat? We can make the argument in a lot of ways. The other reference they use is alterations of host-gut microbiome interactions in multiple sclerosis, which isn't really about their purported statement anyway. So I'm not exactly sure how they hope to substantiate the claim that red meat is so inflammatory here. And if you are concerned about red meat and cancer and mechanisms, please refer to this excellent paper that I've spoken about in the past. The title is Red Meat and Colon Cancer, A Review of the Mechanistic Evidence for Heme in the Context of Risk Assessment Methodology. And the takeaway here is that there is just not enough good evidence to say that N-nitrosyl compounds, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or heterocyclic amines are actually that harmful for humans in reasonable doses that you would get by eating meat twice a day. Unless you are eating the most burned, charred, fried meat on the planet, there's really no good evidence that these things are harmful for humans at all. So I will read from the abstract for a moment so you get the idea here. They say that in order to make claims that polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and heterocyclic amines are harmful for humans, and now I'm quoting, the evidence from in vitro studies utilize conditions that are not necessarily relevant for normal dietary intake and thus do not provide sufficient evidence that heme exposure from typical red meat consumption would increase the risk of colon cancer. What they're saying is that when you're doing experiments in test tubes, they're often using doses that are orders of magnitude higher than what you would get by eating a hamburger or a steak for dinner. They go on to say, animal studies utilized models that tested promotion of precancerous, pre-neoplastic conditions, utilizing diets low in calcium. This is a common trick or a common problem with animal research on heme, heme iron, or any of these compounds from meat in animal models and cancer. They put the animals on a low calcium diet, which we know is pro-cancerous. And when they give the animals enough calcium, they don't get cancer from heme or heme iron. Imagine that. I've talked about the importance of dairy many times and the importance of calcium in the human diet. So make sure you're getting calcium from raw dairy, from microcrystalline hydroxyapatite, bone meal, things like that, etc. I'll continue on the abstract. These diets were high in fat and combined with exaggeration of heme responses that in many instances represented intakes that were orders of magnitude above normal dietary composition, that were orders of magnitude above normal dietary consumption of red meat. We're back to the same thing. Finally, clinical evidence suggests that the type of N-nitrosyl compounds, again, I told you guys this is going to get complex in this podcast, formed after ingestion of red meat in humans consists mainly of nitrosyl iron and nitrosyl thiols, products that have profoundly different chemistries from certain N-nitrosyl species, which have been shown to be tumorigenic, promoting cancer, through the formation of DNA adducts. In conclusion, the methodologies employed in current studies of heme have not provided sufficient documentation that the mechanism studied would contribute to an increased risk of promotion of precancer or colon cancer at usual dietary intakes of red meat in the context of a normal diet. So you guys can read the paper if you want, but I think those authors have hit the nail on the head. And the problem here is that most of now this plant-based, vegan, longevity argument against meat rests on those tenets that we have shown to be very, very shakier. And I'm talking shakier than a foundation built of sand at the Outer Banks when there's a hurricane coming. Shakier than a bamboo-supported house when a tsunami is rolling into the shore. Very, very shaky. This is a house of cards. So the other thing I think it's important to consider now is what happens when you adhere to many of these low animal protein recommendations by eating a plant-based or a vegan or a vegetarian diet. Well, there's really good evidence that when you reduce animal protein and replace it with plant protein, you become more frail. So how is frailty going to get you longevity? I don't know. I don't understand these arguments in the first place, but I'll show you studies to support that claim. We can start with this one, which is titled "Partial Replacement of Animal Proteins with Plant Proteins for 12 Weeks Accelerates Bone Turnover Among Healthy Adults," a randomized clinical trial. You guys get the idea. More plant protein, less animal protein, more fractures. But proponents would want you to believe this is longevity, guys. I don't even know what's going on here. How about this one? Comparative fracture risk in vegetarians and non-vegetarians in Epic Oxford. This is an epidemiology study, but they looked at people who reported vegetarian or vegan diets, and they looked to see how often their bones broke. Well, wouldn't you know it? In this population, fracture risk was similar among meat eaters, fish eaters, and vegetarian. The fracture risk is in vegans is higher and appeared to be a consequence of their considerably lower mean calcium intake. Well, it's probably also a consequence of their mean utilizable protein intake, their lower creatine intake. There are so many factors beyond calcium that could lead to an increased fracture rate. But it's basically undeniable to suggest that if you get rid of enough animal protein to a vegan level, you are going to be frail. You're going to have increased rates of fractures. In the first study, even getting some of the animal protein led to it, as you might in a vegetarian diet. In Epic Oxford, it was the vegans who had an increased rate of fractures. But this is the first takeaway from this podcast, guys. Frailty is not longevity. And look at the vegans you know and ask yourself, do they look frail or do they look strong? I'm not going to answer it for you. I'm just going to ask you the question and you can decide for yourself. Even look at the vegetarians you know, how frail, how strong. Now, to add a caveat to that, let's just think. I think that eggs and milk and cheese are incredibly nutritious foods for humans. There is a way to do a vegetarian diet in a very healthful manner. If you ate eggs and you ate milk and you ate cheese, you could probably do great. I'm not stoked about the absence of organs, specifically things like liver and heart, for choline, for biotin, for riboflavin, for coenzyme Q10, for peptides, for testosterone in the heart, which is beneficial for both males and females. But listen, you could do okay with a vegetarian diet. Now, I think not all vegetarian diets are created equally, just like not all vegan diets are created equally, just like not all carnivore diets or animal-based diets are created equally. But you get what I'm driving at here. I don't think a vegetarian diet is ideal because muscle, meat, and organs are critically valuable sources of nutrition for humans. And to remove those from your diet is to remove some of the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. The authors of this article take a little dig at folks like me saying proponents of high animal diets are often not very knowledgeable about biogerontology, the science of aging. They are unfamiliar with the effects of high animal protein intake on important aging pathways and mechanisms. Well, here's my opinion. Biogerontology, the science of aging, is like this. It's just hand waving. It's voodoo. It's basically epidemiology and animal studies, which are not translated to humans. So I hope that I'm reasonably well informed about this science, but these authors don't believe that anyone who would eat this much meat could be. They say that sometimes high animal protein proponents draw on their own experiences after following a plant-based diet. I wonder if they're writing this article about me. Often they felt worse on such a diet, which can indeed be the case, since a more plant-based diet, especially vegetarian or vegan, can cause deficiencies and other problems, as we will discuss later. Well, at least they admit that, because that's a real major risk. But what's strange and kind of ironic is that they basically are advocating for a plant-based diet in this article. Continuing, they say carnivore dieters assume that in prehistoric times, people ate a lot of meat. A high meat-based diet is best for humans because of this. The two main flaws in this reasoning are, first, scientists don't know if prehistoric people really ate a lot of meat. Well, we sort of do know people ate a lot of meat. And I've talked about this many times in the past. There are lots of good studies looking at stable isotopes in the remains of Neanderthals and in the remains of coexistent Homo sapiens from 40 to 50,000 years ago. This paper is titled "Exceptionally High Delta-15 Nitrogen Values in Collagen Single Amino Acids Confirm Neanderthals as High Trophic Level Carnivores." If you go down this stable isotope rabbit hole, you will find that there are multiple studies now to suggest that, again, both Neanderthals and coexistent Homo sapiens were getting the majority of their protein from animal foods. So suggesting that our ancestors were not eating a lot of meat is, again, just hand waving. There's there's a lot of evidence to the contrary for that. And all hunter-gatherers on the planet existing crave meat. They seek meat all the time. So why would our patterns have changed in the last few thousand years of recorded history? I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. Their second point is valid, and let's address it. Second, even if prehistoric people ate a lot of meat, this does not mean it is healthy. Well, this is getting into the false philosophical narrative that these longevity, quote, experts often will put forth. Nature does not care about us living a long life, they say. It mainly cares about people reproducing as soon as possible. What happens after this is no worry for nature. In fact, that's the reason why aging exists. They're making some pretty bold claims here, I think. It's a little bit, they're a little bit in left field. So what we know about at least current tribes of hunter-gatherers is that they live as long as we do with much better vitality and what is called squaring of the morbidity curve into old age. Estimates of hunter-gatherer life expectancy are confounded by high rates of infant mortality among these people. This means that because many children and infants die, we average all that together and say their life expectancy is low. Well, that's not really accurate because it turns out that being a wild human is dangerous, and some technology that we have as humans today does improve our infant mortality and allows us to move through childhood, a very vulnerable time in our lives, to adulthood. Life expectancy beyond adulthood really tells us about chronic disease, which is what we're talking about. Infant mortality and childhood mortality tells us about dangers in the environment, tells us about septic systems, and tells us about getting bitten by snakes or falling off of cliffs or getting stolen by leopards in the middle of the freaking night, which is what we're afraid of as humans after hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. Why do babies in cribs separated from their parents cry all night? That's a whole separate topic. But they just pile it on here. So even if people in prehistoric times consumed lots of meat and this increased their risk of getting a heart attack when they were 60, this would not be a problem, given most prehistoric people didn't get the chance to get so old. Well, they probably did. The Hadza lived to be 70 or 80, just like us. So these authors are pretty uninformed. We humans, however, have another agenda than nature. We want to live long and healthy life. I agree. And I would add to that, we also want to live strong and be vital and not be frail. So now the authors of this article go on to have 51 points, many of which are redundant and many of which use the same sort of ineffective epidemiologic references. But I'm going to hit some of the high points that they're noting and talk about why I think that they are sort of full of compost? Yeah. So right from the beginning, they say, there are numerous studies that show the people who follow a plant-based diet live longer. And they have these references here, and every single one of these references is epidemiology. Okay. And so the problem is that in this case, it's very easy to ignore all of the studies, which are invariably epidemiology, which do not suggest increased longevity in vegans and vegetarians. This is the definition of cherry picking, saying these are the epidemiology studies that I would like to show to prove my point and ignoring the ones that counteract my point. So this gets back to the idea of healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias and why these are so dangerous. But let's just look at one study which shows that vegans and vegetarians do not actually have increased longevity. This is vegetarian diet and all-cause mortality, evidence from a large population-based Australian cohort called the 45 and Up study. So this is 243,000 participants. And the conclusions are that there was no significant difference in mortality between pesco vegetarians and semi-vegetarians versus regular meat eaters. So pesco vegetarians, semi-vegetarians, did not live longer than meat eaters. We found no evidence that following a vegetarian diet, semi-vegetarian diet, or pesco-vegetarian diet has an independent protective effect on all-cause mortality. And I think that if we really looked carefully at a lot of these populations, we might actually find that this is harmful for humans because of the increased frailty, which is something that's difficult to argue with. So if we start digging into their 51 points, and again, I'm not going to go through all of them, I'm just going to hit the high points here. They begin with the blue zones. Oh, the blue zones. What do we say about the blue zones? Well, they make the claim that there is no longevity zone in the world where people live longer by eating lots of meat or animal protein. I mean, that's just completely false. What about Iceland? I mean, there are people who live long all over the world who have high protein diets. So These authors are completely in left field. Longevity zones, also called blue zones, are areas where people live considerably longer. What all blue zones have in common is that people consume few animal products. Oh, really? Is that true? Is that why people in Ikaria have a dish called gamo pilafo, which is made with goat, and that animal foods are a huge part of the Ikarian diet? Is that why people in Sardinia treasure a local type of pastured pig known as Sarda pig and make it into a local dish known as porcedu? Is that why among Japanese elderly, there were no centenarians in the vegetarians? And I will show you that reference in a moment. And is that why people in the Nicoya region of Costa Rica, among which only males have an exceptional longevity, though that's never talked about in the Blue Zones propaganda, these people eat more meat and more animal fats than their cohort in San Jose or the rest of Costa Rica. And I happen to know this firsthand because I live in Costa Rica. So the blue zones are something I've talked about in previous podcasts. They are basically a very clever false narrative. They're a false characterization of how people live in certain areas and how that may contribute to longevity. So basically, anytime I hear someone say blue zones, I just think that these people have, number one, never been to any of the blue zones, never eaten food with people in the blue zones, and number three, never actually done the research to substantiate any of the claims by Dan Buettner and others, who openly admits that people in the blue zones eat meat, but this just wasn't part of his narrative, so he left it out. The finding regarding the Japanese elderly in Okinawa, that there were no centenarians among vegetarians, is so striking that I want to provide the reference. It is called Nutrition for the Japanese Elderly. The last author is Y. Suyama. And if those of you are watching on YouTube, I will show you the part of the paper where they actually say this very clearly. Unexpectedly, we did not find any vegetarians among the centenarians. The second survey for Japanese centenarians in 1975-1976 showed a similar dietary pattern. Okay, so I do not understand how anyone can claim that Okinawan people who are part of a blue zone have any contribution to their longevity by eating limited quantities of meat when there are no vegetarians among the centenarians. This flies in the face of many of these blue zones claims. The authors, however, double down, saying most people who reach a very old age, e.g. centenarians, do not consume a lot of animal protein. I don't even know where they get this. I mean, none of the studies that they reference here provide any sort of actual substantiation for that claim. They go on. Most studies clearly show that consuming a more plant-based diet is much healthier than a diet high in animal protein. Again, epidemiology, 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 all the way home. There is no solid evidence to substantiate their claims. Protein accumulation is one of the hallmarks of aging. Yes, protein accumulation may be one of the hallmarks of aging, but eating protein in your diet leads to a lower fracture risk, less sarcopenia. There's absolutely no evidence that eating animal meat plays any role in the accumulation of amyloid and Alzheimer's, heart failure, or blood vessel aging, et cetera. In fact, the reverse is probably true. We know that, I would say, blood vessel aging is intimately connected with polyunsaturated fatty acids found in plant foods and seed oils. They go on to say a high animal protein diet can accelerate this process. And the only studies they can use to substantiate this claim are protein restriction studies done in mice who are triple transgenic as part of an Alzheimer's disease mouse model. So what we have are severely inbred mice, triple transgenic. They're called 3XTGCRND8 mouse mice. So these are the triple transgenic mouse model of Alzheimer's disease. And that is the only evidence they can use to substantiate the outlandish claim that a high animal protein diet can accelerate the aging process. When in fact, we know that, at least according to epidemiology, vegans and vegetarians tend to have higher levels of advanced glycation end products than meat eaters. Consider this study looking at the plasma levels of advanced glycation end products in healthy long-term vegetarians and subjects on a Western mixed diet. And what you'll find is that both fluorescent advanced glycation end products and carboxymethylysine levels, that's another advanced glycation end product levels, were significantly lower in omnivores than vegetarians. Okay. How can anyone who is a biogerontologist who claims to be so aware of the science ignore that finding? If we're talking about animal protein contributing to aging or the accumulation of proteins, how do we find more advanced glycation end products, carboxymethylglycine, markers of aging that very few would debate in vegetarians? Well, I don't know. This is why I'm doing this, because I think this article is worth debunking. So if we go back to this article, they say, restricting protein extends lifespan. Well, those are all studies done in mice, and they are restricting protein in animals who are fed a garbage diet. And then they'll say, restricting calories extends lifespan. Restricting the amino acid methionine extends lifespan. Well, yes, it does when you feed mice a crap diet, but what they neglect to tell you is that you don't have to restrict methionine if you just give mice enough glycine, something I've talked about many times in the past. The idea that a glycine deficient diet will mimic excess methionine, and you don't want excess methionine. Thankfully, if you are eating meat with any amount of tendons or connective tissue ground into it, like ground beef or all of the little connective tissue pieces of a steak, then you will be getting enough glycine to balance your methionine. You can also use things like collagen, et cetera. So many of the proponents of meat restriction or methionine restriction will not tell you that simply supplementing glycine abrogates all of the negative effects of excess methionine. And again, we're looking at mouse or rat models in contrived situations where these animals are fed a baseline diet of garbage. I just want to rehash something I've discussed in a previous podcast, which is this idea that caloric restriction leads to longevity. So if you want more about this, go to the longevity podcast that I did, but here's the hot take. Caloric restriction only leads to improvements in metabolic function in humans when those humans are obese. We see that in the calorie trial. Those humans were obese with a BMI up to 27.3, though the authors didn't really say that, though the authors don't make note of that. So there are no good trials in humans showing that an otherwise healthy human benefits from calorie restriction. If you are eating a bunch of garbage, eating less of the garbage will be good for you. And we see this in animal studies as well. If you feed mice a garbage diet and then you give them less of that, they do better. Imagine that. The best illustration of this and the contrasting example that if you feed humans, hypothetically, but in this case, if you feed rhesus monkeys, a ancestrally, evolutionarily consistent monkey diet versus a crap in a bag monkey diet, calorie restriction is only beneficial for the monkeys in the latter case. I'll say that again. There are two major studies of calorie restriction in rhesus monkeys, which will never again be repeated. One done at the NIH, one done at the University of Wisconsin. And if you read the abstract here, you will see that the National Institutes of Aging study detected no significant survival effect. And that is because the monkeys in that study were fed a ancestrally, evolutionarily consistent monkey diet. The new University of Wisconsin study reported a significant positive impact of caloric restriction on survival. These two studies should never be forgotten in our history. They will never be repeated. And any proponent of calorie restriction needs to always add an asterisk that if you are eating a healthy diet, and that is why I do this work, to help us understand what a healthy diet is, it's always open for discussion. There is no point to caloric restriction. It will be harmful for you because we know very clearly. Please refer to the podcast I've done with Georgi Dinkov and discussed with regard to my ketogenic dangerous podcast that fasting, calorie restriction, and even carbohydrate restriction will tank your hormones, will lead to lean muscle mass loss, and will affect your ability to perform in life by also raising sex hormone binding globulin, decreasing free hormones, affecting electrolytes, etc. So being restrictive with regard to your diet in terms of calories, carbohydrates, meat or organs, these are all very bad things for humans if we want to be strong, vital, and live well throughout our long lives. Again, let's consider the importance of sarcopenia in aging and frailty and consider studies like this. Sarcopenia as a predictor of all-cause mortality among older nursing home residents, a systematic review and meta-analysis. I don't think there's any healthy user bias or unhealthy user bias here. But what is very clear is that sarcopenia is a significant predictor of all-cause mortality among older nursing home residents. Well, sarcopenia is going to be unavoidable without adequate amounts of methionine and leucine. These are the amino acids that the longevity community fears. They are quaking in their boots with regard to these amino acids, but these are critical amino acids for the avoidance of sarcopenia. So you can't have it both ways, guys. They just don't understand that frailty is the single greatest risk factor for all-cause mortality and restriction of longevity. And you're not going to avoid frailty unless you eat significant amounts of processed plant protein that is made to look like animal protein, or you just eat animal protein because it is what humans have always been seeking throughout our evolution. It's also very interesting to note that one of the epidemiology studies that is constantly discussed by proponents of plant-based diets or proponents of animal protein restriction for longevity is the Rotterdam study. And the Rotterdam study does show that people who eat less meat live longer, but this is suspect for all of the reasons I've discussed earlier. Healthy user bias, unhealthy user bias, I'll discuss that more in a moment. But what the Rotterdam study also shows is that the more K2 we get, a nutrient found almost exclusively in animal foods, menaquinones, the lower our risks of heart disease, specifically calcific aortic sclerosis and cardiovascular disease. So how can it be that more animal foods equals more K2 because people in Rotterdam are not getting any vitamin K2 from natto? I think that's a safe statement. And then natto is a fermented soybean paste, which is the K2 is not in the soybeans. It's in the bacteria that are fermenting the soybeans. So I don't think the people in Rotterdam are getting any vitamin K2 from that. They're getting vitamin K2 from animal foods. How is it that vitamin K2, a marker for animal foods, is at the same time a very strong predictor of lower rates of cardiovascular disease, but also leading to higher rates of death for people? Well, this doesn't really make a lot of sense because we know that animal foods are the source of K2. We know that the more K2 you get, the better your cardiovascular health. Is it possible that some of the people that also eat animal foods are doing unhealthy behaviors in Rotterdam, like smoking or drinking? I would say so. So this is the problem with epidemiology and the danger of these sorts of studies illustrated once more. Now, not to belabor this point, but it is really difficult to overemphasize the importance of understanding unhealthy user bias and healthy user bias in interpretation of these studies. This is a study that is called the Mortality in British Vegetarians. It is known as the UK Shoppers Study, colloquially. And what the researchers in this study found was that though across the whole population in Britain, vegetarians had a lower death rate than non-vegetarians, if the non-vegetarians with healthy behaviors were compared to vegetarians, there was no difference in death rate, which is to say that vegetarians had no better longevity than meat eaters with healthy habits. This is what we are saying. This is a clear illustration of the problem with healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias. The fact that many vegetarians often have healthy habits, which are great. And I think it's a very clear illustration of the importance of having healthy habits. Moderate amounts of exercise, probably some sunlight, community, regular medical care, though I would be a little bit skeptical of that one these days if your doctor just wants to give you medications. But it also helps to be of a higher socioeconomic status like most vegetarians are, and that leads to improvements in longevity. Likely not any avoidance of meat, because as we know, avoiding meat is going to make it very hard to not become sarcopenic as you age, and that is what makes you die. Authors of this article then go on to talk about signaling pathways that are aging pathways, mTOR, insulin, and IGF-1 pathways, claiming that animal protein activates important, quote-unquote, canonical aging pathways. So what I would suggest the authors of this paper don't understand is that activating those pathways is essential for proper human growth and development. It's essential for proper reproduction. It's essential for proper vitality, libido, and strength throughout your life. And it's essential to avoid frailty as you age. And activating those pathways when you eat is not the same as having those pathways chronically activated or consistently activated in a state of insulin resistance. This is the problem. Oftentimes, we see that diabetics have elevated IGF-1, diabetics have elevated insulin resistance. And in some model systems of mTOR, the mammalian target of rapamycin overactivation, we see increased rates of cancer. But that doesn't mean that activating mTOR, insulin, IGF-1 is a bad thing when it happens after a meal and then doesn't happen when you're sleeping or when you're resting or between meals. Now, the mTOR thing I'll discuss first, and then we'll get into IGF-1 and insulin. But mTOR has been widely vilified. But I'll suggest to you that someone who has no mTOR activation is basically a couch potato who is eating nothing but fat. Because insulin activates mTOR, which means carbohydrates activate mTOR. Protein activates mTOR. Leucine activates mTOR. And guess what? Exercise activates mTOR. So tell me again that mTOR is such a bad thing. You don't want overactivation of mTOR, which means you probably don't want to be eating high fructose corn syrup all the time. You probably don't want to be eating in the middle of the night, and you probably don't want to be eating junk food that's going to overactivate these signaling pathways. But this doesn't mean that signaling that your body, you have abundance, that you've got a fresh kill, that it's okay to grow muscles and be strong and be lean and reproduce or be strong for your tribe is a bad thing. But this seems to be what the longevity community would want for us, to become essentially couch potatoes who don't exercise because you can't activate mTOR. I'm being a little facetious here, but you certainly can't eat any protein and you can't eat any carbohydrates and you have to restrict calories. What's the point of living? And I don't even believe there's any solid evidence to suggest this will extend your life. Even if it did, would you want a life like that? So by both accounts, by both ends of the spectrum, we can say that this strategy is no good for anyone in terms of enjoying your life, having a full life, or showing up in your life as the strongest, best version of yourself. With regard to IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, I'm going to do a little segment here on dairy in a moment, but dairy has often been vilified for activating IGF-1, but I would challenge vegan and vegetarians to show me what their levels of IGF-1 are. I've shown my blood work multiple times and my IGF-1 remains below the average of the human population, often by half or a full standard deviation. So here I am, a 45-year-old male who is exercising, not fearing mTOR with my exercise, who's getting out in the sun, who's eating a lot of meat and organs, either fresh or desiccated like I get from hardened soil. I'm eating fruit and honey and maple syrup and a lot of carbohydrates and a lot of dairy. My IGF-1 should be through the roof, right? Not really. Consistent overactivation of IGF-1 doesn't come from foods that signal abundance to our bodies like meat and organs and dairy. It comes from insulin resistance. And that's what these longevity specialists, these biogerontologists don't understand. Perhaps they need to read more of the research. How do you avoid insulin resistance? Don't overactivate cortisol, don't have a damaged gut, and don't eat polyunsaturated fatty acids, especially in seed oils. So now the authors go after milk. They say milk, a strong stimulator of aging pathways like mTOR, increases mortality and accelerates aging. All of the references they list are things like this, looking at mechanistic hypotheses for a pathogenic role of persistent milk signaling of the mTOR complex of mTOR. Driven by type 2 diabetes. Well, I guess they're suggesting that milk is going to drive diabetes or aging or cardiovascular disease. And I'm not sure how they arrive at that conclusion when there are multiple other studies to suggest the opposite. I won't go through all of these because it would take a long time, but I'll do a whole podcast on dairy in the future. Here's just one or two: dairy consumption and patterns of mortality among Australian adults. Overall intake of dairy products was not associated with mortality. Possible beneficial association between intake of full-fat dairy and cardiovascular mortality needs further assessment and confirmation. So I don't really understand how the authors of this article can be so blatantly ignorant of the articles that contradict what they are claiming and the evolutionary context of these things. The Maasai are a group that drinks tons of dairy and lots of blood, and they are pretty free of chronic disease, and they don't look very excessively aged to me. The relationship between high-fat dairy consumption and obesity, cardiovascular, and metabolic disease. The observational evidence does not support the hypothesis that dairy fat or high-fat dairy foods contribute to obesity or cardiometabolic risk. Suggests that high-fat dairy consumption within typical dietary patterns is inversely associated with obesity, meaning the more dairy that is high-fat dairy, the lower the risk of obesity, which means eat your butter, eat your full-fat dairy, eat your raw whole milk, and eat your cheese. So again, milk haters, beware. I am coming for you. There's also plenty of good evidence that kids who drink full-fat milk are at less of a risk of obesity. So very clear pattern that appears to be beneficial for humans with dairy. And again, I've had a lot of dairy in my diet recently, and I've shown my blood work. I would challenge vegans and vegetarians to show me that their IGF-1 is lower than mine. So any podcast looking to debunk plant-based arguments and longevity arguments would be incomplete without consideration of this paper from Valter Longo. It is an epidemiology study claiming that low protein intake is associated with a major reduction in IGF-1 cancer and overall mortality in the 65 and younger, but not older population. If we just pause for a moment, is it possible that there's some healthy user bias here or some unhealthy user bias here? Because I believe what's happening in the study is that there is healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias, meaning that the people who are eating more protein are doing more unhealthy behaviors. It is impossible to tease these two things out. And the people that are eating less protein are doing more healthy behaviors. And that is why we see a reduction in cancer and mortality less than 65. But I also believe that meat and protein is so important for the human organism that once we get past 65, the unhealthy user bias and the healthy user bias are completely wiped off the map. And even these researchers are forced to admit that over 65, you better not limit protein. So let's just get this straight. These are longevity researchers telling us that eating a low protein diet will increase our longevity. But once you make it to 65, eating a low protein diet will decrease your longevity. That makes a lot of sense to me. It makes absolutely no sense. It makes absolutely no sense, guys. Don't fall for this. This is typical epidemiology being wielded in a very unfortunate way. And even further, it's unfortunate that outlets like National Geographic pick up articles like this behind the news, why a high protein diet in middle age may increase the risk of death. Oh yeah, because you don't want to eat a high protein diet when you're young and you're doing dangerous stuff like jumping into pools and swimming in rivers and jumping off waterfalls and getting smashed on the head by waves. You just want to eat a high protein diet when you're older. This is the type of stuff that happens in the longevity community, guys. I don't get it. It drives me wild. So again, we're back to the dangers of epidemiology. And since I love bashing polyunsaturated fatty acids, I wanted to point out this epidemiology study, which is quite interesting. Margarine intake and the subsequent coronary heart disease risk in men. If you look in the data in this study, what the researchers found was that the people who ate more margarine had a higher rate of cardiovascular disease. No surprise there, because I'm not a fan of polyunsaturated fatty acids and margarine in general. But what was very interesting here was that unhealthy user bias was clearly at play, but it didn't actually confound the results, because the people who ate less margarine, the people that were not listening to mainstream health advice, were people who were smoking more, drinking more, and had more unhealthy behaviors. This is unhealthy user bias. But in this study, the results, the dangers of the margarine were so strong that it outweighed all of those other unhealthy behaviors they were doing. This meant that the healthy user bias of the margarine group was also at play. The people who ate more margarine were the people listening to mainstream health advice in the early 60s and 70s, and they were smoking less, drinking less. This is what's going on here. And we see this clearly illustrated. The people that listen to mainstream health advice eat less meat, and they drink less, and they smoke less. And the people that eat more meat, drink more, smoke more. And when was the last time you went to a barbecue and ate just plain meat? Well, listeners of this podcast might have done that, but most people in America, because we're talking about the Western world here and most of this research, are going to barbecues and they're eating meat with sugar in it, that may be high fructose corn syrup with seed oils. They're eating coleslaw with mayonnaise with high fructose corn syrup and seed oils. They're eating brownies with refined flours. So how many people do you know that are rebels, that don't listen to health advice, that just eat meat with nothing else, no junk food? And again, I'm talking about mainstream westernized Americans, not health conscious people making a distinct choice to eat a carnivore or animal-based diet. And as we mentioned earlier, mTOR, not something that we necessarily want to avoid triggering, not something that we can avoid triggering if we're going to eat any food or do any sort of movement. And then these longevity proponents never discuss that there is an immunological trade-off to an mTOR deficiency, that if you limit mTOR or if you knock out mTOR or if someone developed a drug that blocks mTOR like rapamycin, there are immunologic trade-offs leading to increased infections with microbacterial infections like tuberculosis. So I have major concerns that this rapamycin craze will lead to increased tuberculosis, increased pulmonary infections, increased infections overall. Because guess what? If you don't tell your body that you're thriving, if you don't give your body an abundance signal with protein, specifically the amino acid leucine, carbohydrates, the postprandial insulin signal, your immune system may suffer. Why would we think that we're smarter than hundreds of thousands of years of evolution and that we should do something different than our ancestors have done for hundreds of thousands of years? Because they look pretty healthy to me, and Western medicine is completely ignorant to this. I don't understand why anthropology is not taught in medical schools. That would, I think, create so much dissension among the medical students when they realize that there are still free-living populations of humans on this earth that are free from chronic diseases as we know them today, that are rampant in our population. There are humans living on this earth that are free from obesity, that are free from diabetes, that are free from cardiovascular disease, that are free from autoimmunity, cancer, depression, dementia, et cetera. And guess what? These humans eat meat and organs and lots of animal fat and a good amount of carbohydrates because they'll eat honey anytime they can get it. I'm talking about the Hadza, the Yukong, the Yanomono in Brazil. So many populations around the globe illustrate this. This is a cognitive dissonance that would explode many of the mind of a medical student. So in the rest of this article, the authors generally repeat their claims over and over. And you guys are welcome to read this article online. You can see it here on YouTube if you want to go read this and look at the references. And you'll find that they are epidemiology, animal studies, and that the contradictory epidemiology is ignored. The animal studies are often transgenic mouse models, which probably are not that indicative of human evidence. And then there's hand waving, misinterpretation of the scientific evidence, and bad epidemiology by Walter Longo. Now, perhaps the most insidious part of this article that got me the most triggered was this part on meat, testosterone, and aging. They say that high animal protein diets lead to more testosterone in males. That sounds like a good thing to me. And then they say male sex hormones accelerate aging. What in the world are they talking about there? How could they possibly make that claim? These two references they have here talk about the evolution of sexually dimorphic longevity in humans, saying that in general, females live longer than males. Therefore, testosterone must accelerate aging, right? What? How can the authors make this claim? This is absolutely ridiculous. Well, they go on to suggest that people who are castrated, their testes have been removed so they don't make sex hormones like testosterone, live on average 14 to 19 years longer. So get ready, guys. The next craze in longevity is to cut your balls off. How many years of longevity would you take to cut your balls off? I wouldn't take a single one. But maybe some of the longevity experts out there have already castrated themselves. The world will never know. But I think this is false marketing because though castrados may live longer, it's important to understand, and I will talk about this with Georgi Dinkov on an upcoming podcast, that when you castrate an animal or a human male, which is freaking ridiculous, testosterone, but also estrogen and serotonin are decreased. And if you guys are aware of the sort of Ray Peet way of thinking, it's the estrogen and the serotonin that are harmful for aging, not the testosterone. There's actually a good amount of evidence that the male hormones, specifically DHT, are pro-longevity, and the canonical female hormones like estrogen are harmful for us, though I wouldn't consider estrogen a female hormone the more I dive down this Ray Peet version of thinking about these things, a rabbit hole. I find it very interesting, and it's been a fun thing to explore. And so the authors would say, giving female hormones to males can extend their lifespan. All right, guys, here you go. Take some estrogen, grow man boobs, and cut off your balls if you want to live longer. It's just ridiculous. But I guess that their claim, all joking aside, is that a higher animal protein diet is going to lead to more testosterone. And then they're making these huge leaps, which are not supported by any solid science and actually have some important caveats to consider. The fact that castration removes multiple hormones besides testosterone and androgen, specifically estrogen, testosterone, et cetera. And the idea that more testosterone in males would be a bad thing. I'll let the males in the audience decide if more testosterone is a bad thing. But what we know pretty clearly is that meat improves testosterone, organs improve testosterone. We know that testicle contains testosterone. We had our whole package supplement at Heart and Soil tested by Informed Sports, and it contains bioactive androgens, including testosterone, because it's testicle. So athletes that are being drug tested should probably avoid that one, but the rest of us can benefit from a little extra testosterone in whole package from Heart and Soil. And then we also know that heart contains testosterone, which is found in many of our supplements at Heart and Soil, like Beef Organs or Warrior. So a few more gems in this article. Animal versus plant protein is the heading, and they go on to claim that rats were given plant-based soy protein while the other group received animal-based whey protein. We see that rats on the soy protein live longer. They said rats on the soy protein diet were also considerably healthier. Well, that's interesting. So not only do proponents of longevity, these biogerontologists, want you to cut off your balls or at least chemically castrate yourself, they want you to eat soy protein at the expense of animal protein. Well, that's strange. Do they know that soy protein makes monkeys aggressive? Increased aggressive behavior and decreased affiliative behavior in adult monkeys after long-term consumption of diets rich in soy protein and isoflavones. We know that isoflavones are phytoestrogens. Those are plant-derived estrogens. Okay, so soy protein is making monkeys more aggressive. It's also making chickens more aggressive. Development of pecking damage in layer pullets in relation to dietary protein source is the title of the article. Greater numbers and vigorous pecs pulls were observed in plant protein groups throughout the experiment, although they were significantly higher only between 13 and 16 weeks of age. So soy protein makes chickens peck and pull more. It makes monkeys more aggressive. But what about humans? Well, it's not so good for your sperm and your fertility, guys. Soy food and isoflavone intake in relation to semen quality parameters among men from an infertility clinic. The conclusion is here. These data suggest that higher intake of soy foods and soy isoflavones is associated with lower sperm concentration. So you'll get longer longevity, according to the biogerontologist, if you cut your balls off and chemically castrate yourself and fill yourself with soy protein, which makes chickens angry, primates angry, and men less fertile. I don't know what to say, guys. I just don't know what to say. So you can see this is pretty much the way it goes in this article throughout the rest of the article. The same sort of arguments are employed. At the end, there's a couple that are too good to not mention. I guess because the authors of this article have so many epidemiology references, they felt like they could have a section on anecdotal evidence. And they say, people who eat a lot of animal protein often look considerably older for their age. They look muscular and bulky, in quotes, but they often easily look 10 years older. This was hilarious because we know that vegans and vegetarians have more advanced glycation end products. And I would put myself up against any 45-year-old vegan, and you guys can decide who looks older. But it gets better. The hits keep coming. People who eat lots of animal protein often have a receding hairline or go bald because of the overstimulation of growth pathways, which depletes hair follicle stem cells. So if there is another human on the planet that eats more meat than me, it must be like Thor or one of these huge guys in the bodybuilding world, because I eat a lot of meat and my hairline is fine. And I mean, I don't know. You guys can tell me about receding hairlines here. This is Michael Greger, a prominent vegan advocate. I guess according to this article, they would say he looks much younger than me, even though I think we're almost exactly the same age. And Michael Greger's hairline is certainly better than mine. I'm being facetious. He's completely bald. And if you look at any pictures of this plant-based advocate where he's got his jacket off, you can see that he has a protuberant belly, which may be bloating or gas or who knows what. But they say becoming bald early can be a symptom of accelerated aging, which is also increases the risk of age-related diseases. So they're really grasping at straws now. I think that I'll use my, in the next debate with vegans, I'll use my hairline as the main point of contention. And then they go on to say bodybuilders who take large amounts of animal protein, growth hormone, and male hormones often die considerably younger and have a significantly higher risk of dying. As if the meat and organs they eat, which are completely evolutionarily consistent and totally nutrient rich, are equal contributors to their increased rates of younger death as the human growth hormone and steroids. So anyway, the end of this article really starts to reveal the quality of its construction. Though I believe the authors are well-intentioned, I just think that they've gone way off the deep end. And I love that I could end the podcast with a discussion of my non-receding hairline, my assertion that I probably look my age or younger than my age, and that these are the points that the plant-based advocates or longevity experts want to really drive home as anecdotal evidence. So this has been a technical podcast, guys. I know, I apologize, but I wanted to break down and debunk many of the arguments that are levied against plant protein from a longevity perspective. I could not get to all of their points. It would have taken 3 hours. Nobody would have ever listened. I've essentially addressed all of this on previous podcasts, but I found some new evidence and I wanted to share some new articles and maybe give some different perspectives and put things together in a different way. But here's the take home. Frailty is the number one cause of your dying. And you will avoid frailty by eating meat and organs along with good sources of carbohydrates. If you can't get your organs fresh, get them from Hardened Soil. It's super convenient. HardenedSoil.co is a company that I built and I believe in very strongly. But getting organs in your diet will change the quality of your life, hands down. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors have lived long, productive, chronic illness-free lives, something that is indisputable and is widely ignored by the Western medical establishment in spite, not really in spite of, this is obviously me joking, as they continue to eat lots of meat and organs and always favor those foods preferentially in their diets. The anti-longevity effects of meat are based on epidemiology, which we know is confounded by healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias, animal studies, often with triple transgenic mouse models like the Alzheimer's disease model, and inappropriate considerations of markers of aging and growth pathways like mTOR, IGF-1, insulin, which are all beneficial, but misinterpreted in this context. And the biogerontologists do not understand that phasic activation of these pathways is essential for proper health and development. You do not want to limit mTOR. You do not want to take rapamycin for fear of immunologic side effects as well as many others. You do not want to put your insulin in the toilet as you do on a ketogenic diet because you will develop hormonal issues, electrolyte issues, and so many other things. And you do not want to have no IGF-1 because that is a syndrome of essentially the Laron dwarves who have many other issues, including sleep apnea, sleep issues. All of these things have valuable roles in the human body. And I think they've been inappropriately vilified and demonized. The real takeaway here is do not fear meat. You will be strong. You will be vital. You will look good and you will have a very full, rich life. And you'll probably outlive the vegans and vegetarians, and you might even have a better hairline than them too.